Symphony, Jay Hilder. Liven up and listen in to what's what, who's who, what's happening, and where. You're about to get an inside view into the shape of things to come and things as they really are. We invite you to call in and share your opinions with the movers and shakers who motivate millions of Americans daily. In the next 3 hours, you'll hear what you won't get on the nightly news. We'll separate the facts from the fiction and get down to the issues that count. You'll hear the explosive free world news and inside views from some of the most controversial men and women in the entire world. And now, your host, a man considered to be one of the most powerful personalities in America, Anthony J. Hilder.
This is Anthony J. Hilder, and tonight we're going to be talking about Asia, Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Burma, our men that are still missing in action, in tiger cages, about a nation of people whose tears are not seen, whose cries are not heard, whose people are not free. Our guest tonight is going to be a very famous man, a motion picture, a very famous and successful motion picture was done about this man. He set the pace. He set the trend. He stood up and went in where brave men feared to tread. His name, Colonel Bo Gritz. Bo Gritz, our guest. Though the picture, you may have remembered the picture by the name of Rambo. Bo Gritz went in and actually attempted to do what Sylvester Stallone was only talking about. Dramatic, yes. Here's a man that risked his life and the life of one of the lives of his team. Well, we're going straight to the phones to our very prominent guest, Colonel Bo Gritz. Colonel?
Hello.
My friend. Can you tell us approximately how many missing in action and POWs were left behind when that tragic step was taken, when we pulled out and left these people to die?
Well, Tony, let me get specific, because we know there's 2,500 MIAs, but specifically, there were, in round figures, 600 Americans that were lost in Laos. Officially, we never fought a war in Laos, but everybody, I think, that has studied the war knows that the Vietnamese used the Ho Chi Minh Trail out of the North Vietnam. It went into Laos, and there are about seven passes that then go into South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we fought, there are as many bomb holes along the Ho Chi Minh Trail as there is in Vietnam. 600 Americans, both mostly pilots, but both airmen and special forces that were in ground interdiction missions, were lost in Laos. Now, of the 600, a few, there were only just, I'm talking as many fingers as you got on both hands, were captured by the Vietnamese, and some of them were returned. But not one American was ever returned by the Lao, and I know for a fact that 308 Americans were incarcerated by Laos during the Vietnam War. Dornan, who is a congressman from Southern California...
We're talking about my friend... Congressman Robert Dornan.
That's affirmative. Bob Dornan was over there at this time and a high-ranking Lao official. The reason I'm not going to even try to pronounce his name is because I'm not sure that it's accurate, but he was near the prime minister, or he was the prime minister, made a remark to Dornan and said, "Why won't you allow us to sit at the negotiating table? We have tens of tens," was the quote, "of Americans that we have captured that we also want to make a deal like you're making with the Vietnamese."
Mm-hmm.
Now, Henry Kissinger, for expediency, and because it would have meant more concessions and a longer time, literally created a political crack the size of Laos through which fell 308 Americans that were basically condemned to die.
We're talking about 308 Americans that were condemned to die, really, by Henry Kissinger.
Well, not Henry. He's the messenger. It's the old kill the messenger thing. I think that that our good president, Richard Nixon, decided for political reasons to get out of Vietnam, and he was a very organized person. He said, Henry, get out of there, and get out of there fast, with honor. And so it would have just exacerbated the whole tri-accords if we would have brought Laos into it, because then the Cambodians had some, and they would have wanted to come into it.
Well, now, let's take a look at the situation at that particular time. Richard Nixon, the member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Henry Kissinger, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Michael Goyaneski testified before the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI that Henry Kissinger had worked for ODRA, which is, an affiliate of the Polish secret police, working with the KGB during World War II. Testimony before the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI. This is a man who Nixon bypassed security clearances with.
I think we'll find that the current administration has also bypassed a few security clearances.
There's no question about that. In fact, I was mentioning at the very early portion of the show that during the time of the war for China, there was an individual in the L.A. Committee for a Democratic Far Eastern Policy who was very outspoken for Mao Zedong. His name? Ronald Wilson Reagan. And, of course, Ronald Reagan was a member of the United World Federalist for 13 years, Fabian Socialist Organization, that would like to have brought about world government early on in the 50s, but they were unsuccessful, thank God. And then there's another fellow named George Bush. I think they call him George Skull and Bones Bush. He's a member of the Brotherhood of Death. That's the fraternity out at Yale, who has brought in many high-ranking officials into government. But George Bundy, who advised Kennedy at the Bay of Pigs on the 2506 Brigade's tragedy, was one of the members of the Skull and Bones. So this was Ronald Reagan's number one choice as vice president, to stand or sit beside him and oversee the activities of this country.
Well, Tony, the thing that has me scared is this. I've voted once, as I mentioned to you, for Wallace, because he was the only guy that would speak out about what he was going to do for the war, and I was in the war at that time, and so as more or less a protest vote, I voted for the governor.
No, we voted for the same guy.
Okay, well, now, the thing that's got me scared is that I have since registered myself as a Republican, and I have voted Republican since the war, mm-hmm. because I am a conservative, and I will not vote for George Bush because I have found out things recently that really frighten me about the future of America and the way that we will do things, and it's not by and for the people. And so I'm not a Democrat. I don't even know who's running. I'm just afraid for America. I got two sons in the military, and my military career seems to be, I hope, rapidly waning, because I need to retire. I've been 30 years in the business, and I'm getting too old to be climbing mountains in Laos, Burma, Vietnam, and whatever. I am afraid to vote for Bush. I will not vote for him because of the things I found out recently, and it's a little bit scary, and it's not the way that the greatest nation in the world system is set up to be.
Well, would you explain just where you've been recently? Haven't you been in Burma?
Well, as a matter of fact, my passport doesn't say I've been in Burma, but the fact is that I have. It was not at my own choice. If I were going to pick a vacation spot, it would probably be some nice place with my wife and family.
Well, most guys don't pick Beirut or...
Yeah. So the fact is that there are no prisoners of war in Burma, but I'll capsulize it for you. There was a dear citizen, call him Mr. X.
I was thinking about that today in our conversation. Let's call him Dr. Domino.
Okay, whatever you'd like. Anyway, he is a dear citizen. And he wrote the president a letter and said that General Kunsa, now for those listeners who aren't big on drug trafficking, they wouldn't know the general, but he controls the Golden Triangle, which produces most of the heroin and opium that comes out of Asia and makes its way into the free world. He has 40,000 armed troops. While we were fighting and dying in Vietnam, in Laos and Cambodia, the general was fighting a drug war in the Golden Triangle. The Golden Triangle is bounded in the south by China. It includes some of western Laos, and it includes a large chunk of Burma and some of northern Thailand.
You mean on the north by China?
Well, it's southern China.
Southern China, but on the north of the Golden Triangle.
Affirmative.
Yes, sir.
And the reason they call it Golden Triangle is because that is the area from which the poppies are grown, the refineries are placed, and the general, many people are in there, the old Kuomintang. Two armies worth, when Mao Zedong, as you mentioned before, took over, two armies fled to the south. Now, these are all Chinese. They have no homeland. They are down there in Laos and Burma, and the CIA backed them. They were going to counterattack to retake China. Of course, they never did, and they never will. And so you got two armies of Chinese down there that are now second generation. And what do they do for a living? Well, they grow opium and turn it into heroin. At any rate, then you have the Burmese communists and the white Burmese. Oh, there's about six groups. The bottom line is this. Dear citizen wrote a letter to the president and said that Khun Sa, who is the kingpin for all of the drugs that come out of there, heroin and opium, the hard stuff, that he had an American prisoner of war that he was ready to turn over to the United States on the 27th of October of 1986.
Now, you were talking about, this is a conversation that you had with Dr. Domino.
This is in a letter to the president.
Oh, this is in a letter to the president.
This is what he told the president in a letter, in a written communication. He said that there were five more Americans on the way. He said that there were three American prisoners of war that had been there, and he had tried to help them get across the Mekong River, and that they had drowned along with some of his own men. He said that he was willing to stop the flow of heroin. He said he had a worldwide cure-all for any addict. It only took a day. And so he wanted the United States to open a dialogue that would result in a trade mission. And the fact is, the White House came unglued. They really got excited. I was asked in October if we would take a trip, because the truth is, I have one of the only apparatuses that is available in Southeast Asia that can successfully, every time, infiltrate communist lines. That if we would go to Burma, because the CIA had reported Khun Sa dead for some months, and check out this report that the, quote, highest levels were very excited about the potential of getting back a prisoner of war. So Scott Weekly, who right now is serving 5 years in Lompoc Prison, and I will get into that, I hope, later, but Scott Weekly and I took off with Dear Citizen. Now, I got my own way of operating, and Dear Citizen had told me that...
You're talking about Dr. Domino.
Affirmative. He had said that there was no way that I could ever go into this area, that he would have to work through the Chinese through Taiwan, and that it would be possible for him and him only to possibly meet General Khun Sa to discuss the release of this American, and that we needed a letter from the White House and all this other kind of stuff. So I went ahead and procured a letter from the White House, and I sent him on his way. He needed tickets and money.
Who did you get the letter from?
Well, he'll have to remain unnamed because he's one of the good guys that we want to protect. He's a soldier, and we need all the soldiers we can get up there right now.
All right.
Especially if we got another 4 or 8 years of what we've already had. At any rate, Scott and I, through because I speak Chinese and been dealing with Chinese for the last 9 years, Scott and I, through my own Chinese network, were successful in contacting Khun Sa, and we were, in about a week after arrival in Thailand, inside Burma, about 3 days' travel, in General Khun Sa's headquarters. Khun Sa said we were the first Americans to ever be in his headquarters. And at that point, our mission was only to see if this prisoner of war was there. We got into his headquarters in November, and we stayed November, December. And, of course, the prisoner, according to Dr. Domino, was supposed to be ready for turnover on the 27th of October with five more en route. Well, when we got in there, General Khun Sa knew nothing about any American prisoners of war. When I asked him, I said, we have come, and I showed him the letter from the White House, And I said, we are not drug enforcement, because he had been tried, and assassination attempts are multiple upon his life. There's a very high reward offered by the CIA and other people for his demise. But he said that, we told him, we are not from DEA, we're not from CIA, we are here for one reason only. And then we discussed the Dr. Domino letter to the president. And he looked at me dumbfounded and says, do you think there are any Americans left alive? And I said, I know that there are Americans left alive. And he said, well, I have no knowledge at all of any American prisoners of war. I asked him about the three that had supposedly drowned. He said, total fabrication. I asked him about the five. He said, I have no way at all of trafficking to Vietnam. I don't know about those. I said, do you have one, or do you have one under your control that will be here? And he says, total fabrication. Never heard of it. When I asked him about the world cure-all for heroin, he said, yes, I have that. Any one of my men that I catch using drugs, I cut his head off. And he says, that it works every time. I'm glad to share that with the free world. And maybe I laughed, too. It was a bit of humor. And but then Scott and I, and this was about 1:30 in the morning, we had talked to the general. We knew there were no prisoners. We had risked our lives running various Burmese and Thai roadblocks. We were deep into Burma, and we were going to be there for a while until he could clear us a lane out. About 1:30, I got up, unable to sleep, and Scott asked me, he said, what are you thinking about? And I said, you know, Scott, we are the only Americans to ever be right here with the world's recognized heroin kingpin. How can we not ask him, why in the hell is he running as much? He ran 700 tons of heroin and opium across the border last year. This year, it's going to be 900 tons. And I hope you'll give me time to show you how he can up it by 200, because I found out in May last month when I was there. I said, we just got to talk to him about it, because I got four kids, two of them still with me, and I'm worried about drugs. And I said, you know, we're going to have the mafia mad at us. We're going to have the Thais who are corrupt mad at us. If there are any government officials involved, they're going to be mad at us. I said, we've done our job with POWs. We ought to go home. I said, am I crazy? And he said, Bo, I think you've got to ask the question. We asked the question on videotape of the general, and he looked me in the eye and said, like I was a third grader, and said, Bo, U.S. officials are buying my heroin. They have been for years. They still are.
U.S. officials. So, in other words, U.S. tax dollars that's contributed by us.
Oh, it's a lot more than that. He said
this. Coming to buy heroin.
Well, it's deeper and more than that. I wish that was the end of it, because that would just be one head off of one snake that we could cut, and that'd be it. But unfortunately, it's a little more complex. I was totally just flabbergasted. I thought it was Thais that were on the take. Or I thought it was Orientals. I asked him about six times. And if you view the tapes, which I'll send you, and which the Senate and the House of Representatives have right now, you'll see he gets angry at me. Because for about five times I say, are you trying to tell me that badge-carrying, credential-provided U.S., not Orientals hired by the United States in drug enforcement, but real live Americans who born, bred, and raised in America, that those kinds of people are buying your opium and heroin, and not civilians, but government agents. And he finally, in just exasperation, said, looking at me like I didn't even have a third grade education, he said, how do you think that I was able this last year to move 700 tons of heroin across the border that go right straight to Bangkok, that board aircraft that are flown to your country? He said, how do you think I'd do that without your officials being behind it? And I looked at him and I said, can you prove that? And he says, I will prove it. He said, you go back, you tell the President of the United States that I want to get out of this business because it's no good.
Well, the President of the United States is Commander-in-Chief and the overlord of all of the administration. There is nobody who serves under him who does not serve at the pleasure of the president. He says one thing and does another. He's talking through both sides of his nose, and I believe this big anti-dope thing that Nancy is doing is, in my estimation, a complete and total sham to cover up the activities of the Reagan administration.
Well, here's what happened. I was really excited. One, we had failed. There were no prisoners of war. There was no world cure-all unless you're going to call the guillotine a cure-all for addicts. Mm-hmm. But I was really excited about the prospect that we could literally stop what he has forecasted being 900 tons of heroin this year. We got back to the United States in December, and I immediately dispatched the tapes to the White House, to my contact. It was just before Christmas, as I recall, that I received a call, and I got three fantastics. One was fantastic because the CIA had said that Kunsaw was dead, and yet there he was on videotape talking close up with us. We reached the final thing, and there was no mention about the drugs, and I said, he said, it's fantastic, Bo, that General Kunsaw is going to dispatch his agents to literally search the bushes of Laos for any prisoners of war in his area of influence. And I said, that's not so fantastic. I said, what is fantastic is that General Kunsaw has made an offer to completely stop every ounce of heroin from crossing the border. And he said, Bo, I said, what about that? I said, that's fantastic. And he said, Bo, there's no interest here in that. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, isn't Vice President Bush appointed by President Reagan to be the number one cop in this nation to control drug flow across our borders? And he said, Bo, again, what can I tell you? There is no interest here in that. Now, simultaneously, these things happened. One, Scott was arrested down in San Diego and was charged on something that was absolutely ludicrous and was told by several federal agents that it wasn't what he did that he was being charged for. It was to put a tether on us and that I was the center of the focus. And secondly, we criticized Burma and Thailand for not using the drug suppression funds adequately. Now, we've given them over $100 million in suppression funds. And immediately, according to the newspapers, because I've got, and I'll send to you, about 60 days worth of headlines, where 10,000 Thai soldiers and airstrikes and all that you could imagine from the Vietnam War was sent to fight Kunsaw. 17,000 Burmese were sent to fight Kunsaw. Now, I suddenly saw myself as the target, and I knew that something was wrong, because if we got no interest in the White House at stemming the flow of heroin and opium into this country, then there has got to be a stoppage somewhere.
Well, Bo, there is a statement that was made by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, it was planned that way.
Oh, sure.
Now, Bo, you have on videotape an interview with General Kunsaw, and he is giving you the names of those individuals within the United States government who are buying the heroin that comes into, really, I say murder our society, murder our children, and put us under the yoke of those individuals who are bringing it in. This is by design. If a country is going to fall, it has to be demoralized. It has to be doped up. They have to be concerned with almost everything, but what's really going on behind the scenes, that has to be covered.
Well,
there couldn't possibly be 700 tons of heroin and opium coming into the Western world if it were not with the approval of those in power.
Tony, there's two things that we need to talk to so that listeners can understand what I have learned through practical experience since November. The first thing is that it's almost impossible to ship 900 tons of opium and heroin by muleback, which is what General Kunsaw has done since the early 60s. I went back in May, that's like last month, to ask General Kunsaw, because I got a no interest from the White House, it spooked me a little bit, and my traveling partner, Scott Wheatley, all of a sudden was snared by a bunch of web spinners over something ridiculous, And it looked like they were, that was a warning to me. And so rather than, roll over belly up, I went back over. This time, I did not go over at the charter of the White House. I did not have any expenses paid by them. I took Lance Tremor, who is my long-range radio operator and communications chief. It was on the prisoner of war operations we've run, and still is. I took him as a witness, and I also took my station's chief in Thailand, whose name is Barry Flynn, another American who's from Boston. And the three of us, along with our Chinese guides, went back in to see General Khun Sa and ask him if he wouldn't go one step further. I thought there was a big war going on because the headlines in the newspapers said that some 27,000 Thai and Burmese troops were attacking him, that he would be captured or killed at any day, that his headquarters was under airstrike. And as we went in, we didn't go in by horseback like we did before. It didn't take us 3 days. We got there in 1 day, and we went on a road. Not been suppressed, they have been accelerated. And now Khun Sa, because there was a U.S. ambassador that made the statement that he laughed, because Khun Sa said, I am going to put out 900 tons of opium and heroin this next year. And they said it was impossible. And I also would have thought it impossible, logistically. But not when you have a 10-ton truck that can take it out in that kind of a load. And it goes straight, as a road that runs through the mountains can go, straight into Thailand, straight down the highways, and straight to the airports. So our suppression funds are doing nothing but fattening the corrupt Burmese and Thai officials, and probably a bunch of U.S. also. They did not have a war there. I asked Khun Sa, I said, where's all the bomb holes? Where are the bullet holes? There's no smell of cordite in the air.
It sounds like a massive disinformation and misinformation campaign.
You hit it on the head. He said, he laughed, and he said, that was just a newspaper war. So there'd been a big deal cut between him, the American representatives, the Thais and the Burmese, to have a big fireworks show, kind of like they put on at Fort Benning for all the VIPs every year. We used to call it the Mad Minute. And then they all went away, and for that, he got a road built. The Thais took in payoff the teak trees, and so he will run his 900 tons this year.
While under the illusion of suppressing drugs here in the United States, the Reagan administration is opening up the floodgates for heroin, for opium, for cocaine, for marijuana. It's coming into the United States by the megaton.
Well, let me say this in favor of President Reagan. It isn't just Reagan. For 15 years, we have been giving tens of millions of dollars every year to the Burmese. We gave them 12 Bell helicopters and one fixed wing.
Well, the same people control the show. I mean, we have a one-party system. The oligarchy and the Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission control both political parties.
Okay, well, so I just,
But if we have Bush from the Trilateral Commission, we have 268 or more members from the Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission and Skull and Bones and Bilderbergers in the Reagan administration. We had 19 in the Carter administration. They were stacked under the Ford administration and under Nixon's. Nothing really has changed.
Now, Tony, if you don't mind, what I'm going to do is, because I knew if I went there by myself, even though I have 40 hours of videotapes that I've condensed down to 4 hours, that represent the two trips, I took with me two other American citizens that would act as witnesses. I'd like to put on Lance Tremor, and again, he's a private investigator that works out of Petaluma. I would like for him to talk to you about the names that were read to us out of a logbook. Now, let me preface it by this. When I asked Khun Sa to do this, he understood that when I turned the tapes over to the White House, that all of this was happening to him because of political reasons. And so he said, I will not cut my own throat, Bo. He said, I will give you the names of the current U.S. officials that are buying heroin and opium from me today. He said, but I will give you the names of U.S. officials who I have dealt with in the past. Now, you got to understand, the guys that buy heroin and opium, they're close. It means they're geographically in Southeast Asia. And I said, just give me anything that you will. And then he said, but I will go ahead and reveal all of the sources if the United States will give us some kind of crop substitution. He said, give me one-tenth of what you give the Burmese for suppression of drugs, and I will completely eliminate the flow of heroin from the Golden Triangle. Now, he gave us these names, and I'll turn Lance over and let Lance, because Lance wrote this statement as General Kunsaw's general secretary was reading out of a logbook that they had maintained.
I would like to get, now we are ready to hear the names of those individuals in the U.S. government who are buying heroin. This is according to testimony from Lance Tremmer. Lance, are you there?
Yeah. Tony?
This was at what period of time? During what period of time?
Oh, this was just last month.
I know it. You got the information last month, but when were they buying heroin?
First of all, let me put it this way. I don't have anything here that says they were buying heroin. They didn't go out with the money and say, here, let me buy this heroin. They've been involved in this for a long time. This goes back in the early 1960s,
mm-hmm.
When this first started.
This is according to the secretary of General Kunsa.
Yes.
This is according to what he says.
Yeah, what happened was, first of all...
So we're not saying that these people actually bought heroin. We're just simply saying that these are the names that General Kunsa's secretary gave to you.
Yes. Let me explain it this way. First of all, while we were talking to them, Bo first questioned Kunsa about the POWs. That was the main reason why we were there. I might add something else to this thing. I am a member of Operation Lazarus, which we started under Bo back in early 1982. And the sole purpose of Operation Lazarus is to find and bring home American POWs who are left behind in Southeast Asia. And we went over there strictly for this information on the POWs and to find out about the drugs. You've got to remember now, I didn't go with them with Scott and Bo back in December. Bo asked me last month if I would accompany him because he told you about Scott's problem.
That's correct.
Well, anyway, when we got there, we were there for 7 days, and one day was the interview of Kunsaw and his officers. And first thing Bo questioned Kunsaw was about the POWs. And Kunsaw told us that there was no evidence of American POWs being in the area of his operation in Laos. Now, this wasn't any surprise because we never had any reports of American POWs being in that particular area. And it's also believed that Kunsaw probably went a lot further, than he said he did on checking this POW situation.
So we're talking about the missing 308
Yes.
Americans.
Well, yeah, we're talking now, Tony, the Western. See, Kunsaw only has influence over Western Laos, now, not the Ho Chi Minh Trail area.
Well, there's three independent armies, are there not?
Yeah, but let's go ahead and let Lance, if you would, get into the prime meat of this thing about the U.S. officials that Kunsaw said over the years that he had dealt with in heroin and opium.
Yes.
All right, Tony. Well, as I said, he checked his area of operation, which came as no surprise. But then we talked about the drugs. Now, Dr. C.E. Shan, who acted as Kunsaw's interpreter, he told us that he has gone to Bangkok several times under the orders of Kunsaw. This was several years ago that he talked about also.
Yes.
And he talked personally with a man at the American Embassy named Colonel Denny Lane. Now, Colonel Denny Lane is still assigned over there somewhere in Bangkok, as far as I know. But Dr. Shan said that he offered any and all cooperation to the Drug Enforcement Agency to eliminate the smuggling of opium from Shanland to the world. He said that all offers were flatly rejected. He said it was interesting to know also that DEA knew all about the drug trafficking but would not take any action against it. And he said whenever he talked with Colonel Lane or any DEA official, they always asked him sensitive questions about Kunsaw that he would not answer. They always tried following him whenever he moved around. And he said it was obvious they wanted to locate Kunsaw. There's a $5 million reward on Kunsaw's head. And he thinks it's obvious that they're not interested in eliminating the drugs. They're only interested in killing Kunsaw. But Kunsaw then turned the floor over to his secretary. Now, this is all videotaped.
Yes.
Who has kept the logs and the records of their transactions. And in his records, he read, from 1965 to 1975, there was a CIA agent in Laos named Shackley. Now, Shackley was involved with Mao Zedong, who was a leading drug smuggler during that time. Mao Zedong was captured by the Thais in 1973, and I believe he was turned over to Burmese or somebody at the time. Shackley used a civilian named Santo Trafficante, who organized and trafficked the drugs for him. Now, I believe Santo is dead just recently. He also read from his records that Richard Armitage financed the smuggling of drugs while in Vietnam. After Vietnam, Armitage was a prominent figure in drugs in Bangkok. He was very active in drugs in Bangkok from 1975 until 1979. And at that time, he was an embassy employee. Until leaving after 1979, he established the Far East Trading Company. And he used this company to traffic drugs. He said that the money from the drugs was used to support the Lao people with weapons and ammunition. He said that Armitage has a lot of Lao and Thai friends who helped him, and there were also many CIA agents who helped him.
Lance Trimmer, could you identify this Richard Armitage? We have an assistant secretary of defense under Caspar Weinberger, an appointee of the President of the United States. What is his name?
Richard Armitage?
That's correct. We're talking about the same man?
That's the same man.
Well, I think that says it all. I don't know how the public of the United States can accept Ronald Reagan saying one thing and doing another. I remember in 1982 he got up at the White House and took credit for the greatest tax decrease in American history, when about 10 days before he gave us the greatest tax increase in American history. And the congressional primary winners stood up and applauded, save one. And that's our guest tomorrow night, Gary Richard Arnold.
All right, Tony, let me say one thing to you, though. You've got to remember that this started many years ago before Ronald Reagan took office.
I know, but Ronald Reagan has appointed him.
Well, that's true.
And he is talking, you know, heavy drug control on one side, and he's got the floodgates open, and it's going
well,
to...
Well, I was just totally amazed, this Bo again, when I got a, quote, no interest from the White House on something that would completely eliminate 900 potential tons of heroin, and that shocked me and made me wonder about what's going on up there in Washington, D.C., and I served there for 4 years.
I think we know what's going on up there.
Well, another interesting thing, you know, they're talking about when this, when Armitage was real active in this thing, like from 1975 to 79.
Yeah.
And it came to my attention the other day that I believe that Mr. Bush was headed up the CIA during 1976. Well, you know, you could say just about anything, and it really wouldn't surprise me. Not with what I see that's going on in our government today and the things that we found out in Burma just a couple of weeks ago. You know, I just can't be surprised by what our government does.
Well, you have a videotape. You also have an audio tape.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, what I'll do is I'll ask Lance to hang up his extension and find on the tape that particular part, and if you want, we can play it for you right over the phone.
Yes, I would like that.
Okay. Let me ask him to do that, and let me tell you why. People ask the question, and it's a very good question. They say, why would the government do this? Well, it's the same question they ask me all the time. Why would the government not bring prisoners of war home? And I just couldn't really answer that question. To me, it was a total mystery until now. Now I know why the government doesn't bring American prisoners of war home.
Well, I believe if there were American prisoners of war freed right now, and they attempted to come into the United States, and it was known to the Central Intelligence Agency, they would be dead within minutes.
Well, the reason that they... let me tell you what happened, Tony. I've got advanced degrees in universities, but I must not be too smart, because about 4 years ago, people were telling me that we would never be able to bring a prisoner of war out of Southeast Asia. And I said, why is that? And they said, because it is inextricably intertwined with drug operations. And it was a total mystery. I said, how could that be? I said, the prisoners growing drugs or something? And they said, Bo, we can't tell you. We'll only tell you that it is combined with drugs. Well, I know the answer now. The answer is this. The people in government who have been charged with seeking and bringing back prisoners of war officially are the same ones that have been involved in drug trafficking. When prisoners of war come home, one of the first questions that people like you are going to ask is, what the hell took you so long? And we are going to examine very carefully those men in office who are responsible for finding and releasing those prisoners. And we're going to find that there is this big brotherhood you were talking about, and this brotherhood was trafficking in opium and heroin when they were supposed to be looking for American prisoners of war. So that's the reason why that the U.S., and for one case, why we've been unsuccessful so far, I think. If I may also add, why the U.S. government, because it isn't the government, it's the people in the government, are trafficking in these things. Number one is that when Nixon was there, he was very organized. He had 40 men that took care of all of his functions. And I think what happened is when the war was declared officially over in 1973, all prisoners are home, the war is over, we're out with honor. I believe Nixon told...
Wait a minute, you say out with honor. That's not true.
Oh, no, that's what he said, though.
But Henry Gore Kissinger allowed some 300,000 Viet Minh and Viet Cong just to remain armed.
Of course, but you and I, when we watched the homecoming in February of 1973, we heard the president say, all of the prisoners are home, we are out with honor. So, of course, if the president says it, then that's it, right?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a difference between George Washington, who never told a lie, and Richard Nixon, who never told the truth.
Yeah, well, let me tell you what I do know about this thing, because I've been in the government now and operated within its structure for 30 years. In covert activities. And here's what I've learned. I believe that Nixon told his covert operator in the Nixon 40 to go ahead and try to win the war covertly if he could. But he couldn't have any money because Congress thought the war was over. Well, the way they financed the secret combination, which we can now call a Contra committee or so, is by selling drugs, meaning heroin and opium, and using the money to supply those assassins that were hired by them. The idea was a good one. Here's what I think happened. As a matter of fact, I know this happened. There was an operation called Phoenix. The operation was an assassination combination. The idea was that you assassinated all of the supporters of the communist regime, causing like a building would to just sort of collapse in on itself. Now, the theory for the thinkers in the ivory towers back on the East Coast is a good one, but it doesn't work in the implementation because the shooters are thugs.
I don't buy the implosion theory. I think that the reason that this is occurring today is to collapse this country.
It didn't work in Vietnam. It didn't work in Cambodia. It hasn't worked in Laos. They took it to the Shah then of Iran.
It was never intended to work.
Well, I think that there were people who actually thought that it could work because there were millions of dollars involved. And the Shah of Iran, they tried to use the same model. It didn't work there.
Well, I think the Ali Norths and some of the underlings who work, for the White House would believe that they're actually doing good and are the benefit to the anti-communist crusade throughout the world.
Please stop now, turn the cassette over at this point, and begin playing 5-2.
States Navy from 1942 to 1946. He was in both the Atlantic and Pacific theaters as a pharmacist mate, first class, aboard a destroyer escort. He became involved in political and patriotic work when he noticed that the premier columnist of the local morning paper had been suddenly replaced, apparently for his conservative leanings. Al began working for patriotic groups in the early 60s when it became obvious that the one-worlders had seized control of the United States and were selling out the leaders of South Vietnam and plunging us into war. Several years ago, Al began to realize that unless something was done very quickly, the freedoms we in the United States now enjoy will cease to exist. The communists, with the aid and support of the one-worlders, had succeeded in almost every major goal of this drive to destroy us. Al quickly realized that while we were fighting each of the separate issues like abortion, education, the Second Amendment, etc., and this was important, he also realized that we had no clear sense of direction or a well-defined plan for victory over those evil forces that would destroy us, that we must fight the root cause of the cancer currently infecting America, the conspiracy known as the New World Order. At this time, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Mr. Alfred Aronson, president of Keep America Independent. Al, welcome.
Thank you very much, Margie, for that wonderful introduction and for your hospitality from you and Charles and all the rest of the really fine people here. Believe me, it encourages me, because down in Baltimore, it's a lot worse, believe me. It's almost a complete takeover down in Baltimore. It's just brutal. The propaganda pours out. But I was in Phoenix, Arizona a few weeks ago, and they have a wonderful group there. I was encouraged by that. I was highly encouraged when I saw Margie and the wonderful production program that she had here. And I think I formulated a victory program based on what I saw today that I think can save America and the free world. And I think Margie Provan is going to be the patriot who does that. All right. In 1932, a man by the name of Aldous Huxley wrote a book called Brave New World. And in this book, he told the story of what happens when a group of social engineers form a perfect society, a utopia. It was a horror story. And I'm going to tell you now what made it a horror story. You will be shocked to see and hear how close America has come to the horror story of the Brave New World. I will add comments to the items as we go. Private property is condemned. The state determines the nature of all man's functions, his hours of labor, what and how much he eats and drinks, the clothing he wears, his education and housing, where and when he may travel, and so on. Utopian man is forbidden to entertain feelings differing in any way from those dictated by the state. Art is dehumanized. There is no such thing as artistic freedom. There is rigid class stratification, and society is reconstructed by a handful of people. The kind of work a man performs depends on which group he belongs to. Breeding is emphasized so that the best brains will be recognized and utilized, and society will not be weighed down by the burden of supporting people incapable of performing any kind of work. The family unit is abolished for the same reason as private property, because it is dangerous to state unity. Ford has replaced God. Happiness is conceived purely in terms of the material. Brave New World contains no families, since these would undermine the state. Sexual promiscuity is an expected social observance. It is fortified by the issuance of sex hormone chewing gum. Emotional and drawn-out sex relationships are continued the height of indecorum. Foremost among smutty words are family, childbirth, and home. From the earliest age, children are to engage in erotic play because the state has determined that the efficiency of adults is impaired by sexual inhibition. History has been either suppressed or rewritten to suit the world controllers. Individuals are conditioned to think, act, feel, believe, and respond the way the government wants them to. Predestination is the act of deciding the individual's fate or destiny for him. Old and New Testaments refer to God as the predestinator. But since the world state has eliminated God, Predestination is now the function of a government bureau. In the world state, each individual has been predestined according to the needs of society. In the world state, mandatory birth control measures are used to regulate the growth of population. Society in Brave New World is state-centered rather than God-centered. Ford, the great leader, is considered to be a supernatural being and is looked to as the source of inspiration and wisdom. What the world state considers to be normal, we consider to be abnormal and immoral. There are many references to sexual activity. In this world, man's beliefs have been completely reversed and eliminated. Man is no longer responsible for himself. The state is his master. Man is simply a cog in the wheel. Therefore, the individual uses sex as he would use a telephone, a spoon, a car, because it is needed at the moment. The individual must not fall in love, marry, and raise children, because this would demand allegiance to others, and the individual's allegiance is to the state only. This is the moral and political climate now being pushed on America. And, of course, the one-worlders as are succeeding. Around 15 years after Huxley wrote Brave New World, a man by the name of George Orwell wrote another book. This one was called 1984, and just about everyone knows it as the classic tale of brutal one-world dictatorship. Here are some of the things that Orwell talked about in his book. It was a world developing fear, hatred, sadism, and insane glorification of brute force. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. This would be due to a completely secularized age, which is what is happening today with the removal of religion from public life. Slogans were propaganda such as, war is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength. The inner party, 2% of the whole, controls the whole society. Next are the outer party, and then come the proles, who are the workers. War is perpetual. The three super states keep their populations busy. The three states prop each other up, even though they are either mortal enemies or uneasy allies. You see this picture in the U.S. sending billions to Soviet Union and Red China. People survive through doublethink, in which a person controls his mind so that he will not allow himself to think thoughts not approved by the party. The past is constantly altered in the Ministry of Truth. The government is monolithic and centralized. It contains four gigantic ministries, the Ministry of Truth, News, Entertainment, Education, and the Fine Arts, Ministry of Peace, which concerns itself with war, the Ministry of Love, which maintains law and order, and maintains the secret police, and the Ministry of Plenty, which is responsible for economic affairs. In Newspeak, these are called many true, many paths, many love, and many plenty. In the Ministry of Truth, they work to falsify history. The party slogan is, who controls the past controls the future. And you see this here in America today. In 1984, they have the two-minute hate, in which they gather to hate the man representing the enemy. This is true today, although it is more like 24 hours. In the end, Winston Smith, the hero, has been broken by inhuman torture. He is allowed to live, although it is a living death. He is forced to betray his lover and becomes a reformed thought criminal. Then he looks up at the picture of Big Brother and smiles. He has learned to love Big Brother. Huxley and Orwell had a certain group in mind when they wrote their warnings. That group, of course, is the one known as one-worlders, social engineers who fancy that they will control the world. And since people who control the world do not like things to move around, you will lose every right and freedom you have. Two books have made a profound mark on the world. One was The Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx, and the other was Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. But as awful as those two writings were, nothing can compare with the sheer, fiendish, ruthless, savage, and bestial quality of the book I hold in my hand here, entitled Enhancing Global Human Rights. It is a guidebook or manual on how the one-worlders will rule the world. Let me read from it so that you can get the full flavor. First, the names on the cover are Rogues Gallery of One-Worlders, published by the Council on Foreign Relations. It bears the names of Cyrus R. Vance, Reverend Theodore M. Hesburgh, W. Michael Blumenthal, Richard N. Cooper, Henry A. Kissinger, Paul Volcker, and many others from the world establishment. Here is the general tone just from the first 12 pages. On page 2, attack on Brazil. This was back when Brazil was an anti-communist country. Page 3, an attack on nuclear power, an attack on Iran and Brazil when Iran was under the Shah. Mild attack on the Soviet KGB, neutralized by equating the same with the American FBI. Attack on Argentina and Ulster. Attack on Uganda, attack on Ethiopia, but very mild. Attack on the Soviet Union, neutralized by equating same with South Korea. Attack on Franco, Spain, and the Greek junta of colonels when they were anti-communist. Page 5, push for so-called human needs, housing, nutrition, medical care, etc. Tries to set up new human rights, which are really socialism or communism. Thus, if you oppose communism, you are guilty of opposing human rights. This is sick. Page 6, attack on Western market economy states. The latter have responsibility to aid poor countries. Pushes transfer of resources from rich to poor countries and for structural changes in the world economy to assure that such resource transfers occur on a regular and continuing rather than on an ad hoc basis. Meaning that the American taxpayer will provide welfare for the rest of the world and pay the bills for the one-worlders. Page 7 pushes concept of human needs being the same as human rights. In that way, if some people in a capitalist society are at the bottom, this is a violation of human rights. In a communist society where theoretically all are equal, this violation of human rights does not occur. The studies in the book explore three aspects of human rights. Define human rights and devise indicators by means of which the behavior of governments might be assessed. Who should do the monitoring and how it should be done, and how to bring violating governments into line. In other words, they are going to control the governments of the world. Page 8, human rights indicators would include the following: power, respect, rectitude, affection, wealth, well-being, skills, and enlightenment. Freedom of speech, religion, press are not mentioned. Dominguez says that his value categories may not be fully satisfactory. However, he says they are more satisfactory than any other sets of categories now being used. Note, when a man or group of men decide to establish values by which to judge every man on earth, then it surely follows that these people are stark raving mad. Page 10 pushes Amnesty International, which has a communist as one of its leading members. Again, pushes so-called human needs as human rights. Page 11 pushes design for a new broad-based monitoring agency whose mandate would include the whole spectrum of human rights. Follow the lead of International Labor Organization, the World Bank, the UN Development Program, and the World Health Organization to develop indices of adequacy. Page 12, Professor Richard Falk is offended by national boundaries. State sovereignty, he feels, is too often the refuge of racist bigots or scoundrels. He would move to do something and proposes actual war against South Africa. Page 50, support for Cuba. Page 224, East Germany appears to be administered in a totalitarian fashion. A country surrounded by the Berlin Wall, or divided by the Berlin Wall. Questions whether Soviet Union is totalitarian. Page 236, how to overthrow South Africa. And page 245, the conclusions, calls for a new world order which would be run by private groups which presumably would be run by them. This is necessary, it says here, because national sovereignty prevents them from running the world. And this is the essence of this book published by the Council on Foreign Relations, you see. Now, after reading this book, there simply is no doubt as to what the one-worlders are doing and how they are doing it. Then what's wrong? Why aren't our conservative opinion makers that I call the COM speaking out about this and demanding that it be stopped? And the reason is as follows. Nobody can steal your house. It's simply too big. At the first sign of somebody banging on your pipes, you'd be downstairs and out the door and demanding to know what's going on. Why are they digging up your foundations and trampling on your geraniums and cutting your pipes? But if you were satisfied with a mind-boggling declaration that they were just taking your house out for an airing, and you stood by while they did it, then you would be a great fool indeed. And yet that's just what is happening. Our COMs, our conservative opinion makers, are so brainwashed by the enemy that they are afraid to speak out while the one-worlders steal their country. And that's why we are losing. Our conservative opinion makers are afraid of being called extremists. Now, that's foolish, because after the one-worlders succeed in surrendering America, all of the COMs will promptly be labeled war criminals for fighting against communism and promptly executed. This is already in the morning paper, where they pay great tribute to the Argentinians who have put the previous administration on trial for war crimes, crimes against the humanity, which turns out to be fighting against communism. And this is the war crimes of the future. In other words, either you fight now or it's all over. But how can we be absolutely sure that the one worlders are actually selling out America? Here's how we know. I give you the story of Johnny. A child is born. His proud parents take him home and they name him Johnny. Or was it Jacob? I don't remember. And Johnny grew up like most American boys. First a little toddler, then into elementary school, then into high school, where he did all the things that kids love to do. Play baseball and football and go to dances and just be a normal American kid. When Johnny was 13 or 14, he was confirmed in the Church of Johnny. Or did he become bar mitzvah in the synagogue as Jacob? I don't remember. Anyway, he was a typical teenager, a lovable, handsome boy who was a pride and joy to his parents. When Johnny was 18, the one-worlders killed him. But before they killed him, they gouged out his eyes, they cut off his ears and his nose, they skinned him alive, and they cut off his arms and his legs. They called it the Vietnam War, but it was no war. It was murder, because the people who sent him off to die in that no-win war knew full well that they did not intend to win. Their sole purpose was to create a state of pacifism in America known as the Vietnam Syndrome, a psychotic state of mind that whimpers and hisses, "You must not fight against communism," which they regard as the wave of the future. And to drive the point home even more viciously, they turned to the grieving, heartbroken parents of Johnny and called their precious son, who lay dead in his grave, they called him a war criminal. That's how ruthless, savage, and bestial the one-worlders are. Perhaps even that is enough to convince you. So I'll tell you about the most fiendish, deadly, degenerate action ever taken by a group of people in human history. The name of this action was the Rules of Engagement, as laid down for American fighting men in Vietnam by Robert S. McNamara, Secretary of Defense, in the 1960s. These rules made it impossible for America to win. And even more sickening, it made it impossible for the communist enemy to lose. And all of this was done to produce the Vietnam Syndrome. We can't even defend ourselves from the communist enemy on our doorstep without hearing the treasonous cries of this propaganda message. Let me read you just one small fragment from these rules, which were published in the Congressional Record by Barry Goldwater. Mr. Goldwater says, "Mr. President, U.S. military forces have been much maligned by some people in this country who blame the military for what they call the loss of the war in Vietnam. However, the armed forces did not suffer a military feat in any sense of that term. Rather, it was civilian managers of the U.S. government who denied our military forces a victory by imposing a complex and lengthy set of restrictions on what the military could and could not do in South Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and North Vietnam. These layers of restrictions, which were constantly changing and were almost impossible to memorize or understand, although it was required of our pilots, granted huge sanctuary areas to the enemy. When certain limits would at least be removed after repeated appeals by the Joint Chiefs, the reductions were made only in gradual steps and seldom were strong enough to serve our strategic ends. Numerous partial and total bombing halts interrupted the effectiveness of earlier bombing campaigns. Often when limited extensions of target areas were granted, they were unexpectedly canceled and withdrawn shortly afterward. These newly public documents clearly reveal the excessive restraints our military units had to operate under in Vietnam. For example, one rule told American pilots they were not permitted to attack a North Vietnam MiG sitting on the runway. The only time it could be attacked was after it was in flight, was identified, and showed hostile intentions. Even then, its base could not be bombed. The same hostile intention rule applied to truck convoys driving on highways in Laos and North Vietnam. In some regions, enemy trucks could evade attack by simply driving off the road. Military truck parks located just over 200 yards away from a road could not be destroyed. Another rule provided that SAM missile sites could not be struck while they were under construction, but only after they became operational. And we comment, these are not rules of engagement. These are rules for surrender. Nobody has the right to tell an American boy he cannot shoot at the enemy, especially when nobody was telling the enemy he could not shoot at an American boy. There's a solemn obligation of the leaders of a country to protect the life of the American boy. But they didn't do that. No, they protected the life of the communist enemy. And that's how the Vietnam War was deliberately fought to lose. I give you now the story of POWs in Vietnam. Their story has been told in heartbreaking detail in the book POW by John Hubble. No decent person can read about the savage, inhuman treatment of these brave men without feeling a deep sense of shame and disgust towards the one-worlders who ran with their propaganda machine called a moderate war. It was not moderate for these men. They had their bones broken inch by inch, their shoulders torn out of the sockets, and their bodies beaten so badly that the flesh came off their bones like mincemeat. This went on for years while the likes of Jane Fonda and Ramsey Clark pranced around supporting the enemy. This was truly a tragic time for people of conscience and belief. But out of the book on the tragic sufferings of these victims of communist terror came a paragraph which is so enlightening and so informative that it can very well serve as a blueprint on how to win over the communist enemy. I should note here that communism is our nominal enemy, but they could never threaten us without the aid and support of the one-worlders. I read this paragraph as it appears in the book POW by John Hubble. American prisoners of war were told over and over by their communist captors that Hanoi was well aware that it could not defeat the U.S. on the battlefield, but that it fully expected to win the war, and it would win decisively on the propaganda front. It would bring a weight of world and American opinion against the American war effort in Vietnam, and in time, that weight would prove irresistible. As they say it themselves, ladies and gentlemen, the communist enemy regards American public opinion as the most important front for their campaign to overthrow us. But how could this be? The great mass of American people do not read the communist press. That is true. But they do read the American press. And they do watch the American television. And they do listen to American commentators. And right there is where America is losing its fight for survival. The American press has declared war on America. What a shocking thing to say, and yet it's true. The evidence is so overwhelming that I won't even bother to present examples. We have all seen it and know it's there. The reason, of course, is to weaken and undermine America so that this country will allow itself to be forced into the New World Order. And the result of all this treason is what we call the Chart of Death. And let me show you this, one of the most shocking things I've ever produced, but it shows since 1949. Since 1949, beginning with China, sold out by the U.S. State Department, Secretary of State Dean Acheson, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the result, communist murder, communist takeover. 59, Cuba, Dulles, CFR, 1962, Laos, Dean Russ, CFR, 1963, South Vietnam, Dean Russ, CFR, Cambodia, CFR. 1975, Mozambique, Henry Kissinger, CFR. 1975, Angola, CFR. Iran in 1979, Cyrus Vance, CFR. 1979, Nicaragua, Cyrus Vance, CFR. 1979, Rhodesia, Cyrus Vance, CFR. The Philippines in 1985, it's halfway there. Now the anti-communist has been overthrown. This is only a transition stage. 1986, South Africa, George Shull, CFR. I was there recently, and they're on the point of overthrow. The U.S. State Department has declared war on them. They've already declared them a hostile country, and this is the lifeline of America. And 1989 is the intended date for the overthrow of America under the guise of the new Constitution. And this is what is going. There's a tragic story. It's all here. And on the right-hand side, you see that long row of red hammer and sickles that could never be there without the one worlders. In closing, my dear friends, I wish to emphasize that this concept of the New World Order is not a popular movement. Most people do not know anything about it. It does not have popular support. Therefore, when you expose it, you're really telling decent, innocent Americans what is being done to their country. After that, the rest is up to them. You can be very sure that very few of them want to be merged in with the Russians. Now, what to do about all this? The first thing you must do is name the game, the New World Order. You cannot win over something unless you name what it is that you're fighting. Then you say no to it. Producing say no to the New World Order. And the easiest, quickest, low-cost way to do that is to use the envelope stickers that I've shown here. And anyway, These that I've shown here. If you use these, people will ask you, what do you mean by the New World Order? And then you tell them. And they say, does this have anything to do with equal rights of men? You say, that's part of it. Does this have anything to do with abortion? Yes, that's part of it. Does this have anything to do with the fight in South Africa? Yes, that's part of it. But you always begin with the New World Order. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I come from a Jewish liberal milieu. I myself am a conservative Jew. And I could never approach these people on an issue because their minds are made up. But when I say New World Order, they won't let me out the door until I tell them what it is. That's how deadly it is. We also have bumper stickers. We also have bumper stickers, which are important also. And we have other literature to name the game. In other words, the point I'm trying to make is the reason we have been losing is that our decent Americans are fighting the issues. They're fighting without intelligence. They are reacting to the issue because they know deep down it's wrong, but they don't know why. So all I'm asking you to do is, yes, fight the issues, but always under the banner of the New World Order. The goal is to introduce three magic words, New World Order, into the public arena. When you have done that, you will have exposed the conspiracy and saved your country. In other words, you can't expose it by naming the issue. You're fighting in the wrong direction that way, because by the time you get through the issue, you've already lost the person. But when you name the name of the game first, then they'll listen to you on the issue. You will be the leaders in this great campaign. And here's the kind of leaders you will be. I turn to the story of General Douglas A. MacArthur in World War I. MacArthur had just been placed in command of his brigade. He went forward to the battalion that was to lead the way. He said to the major in command, "Now when that barrage lifts, I want you to go forward and lead the way. Don't stand back." He says, "They will follow you. You can't take it by standing back and telling them to go ahead. But you show the way and you can take it right up to the top. You do this and I will see that you get the Distinguished Service Cross." Then MacArthur stepped back and looked at him and said, "I see you're going to do it now. You've got it now." And then he took off his own Distinguished Service Cross decoration and pinned it on him as the barrage lifted. And General Pershing said, "It is one of the greatest cases of intelligence, psychological leadership, and direction I have ever encountered. When you name the game, you give people something around which to rally. It's a battle cry, a statement of principles. It's a bold, courageous, dynamic statement that tells the enemy we are a brave, dedicated people, that we will never surrender. that we are under their game. We don't want it, and we're going to see to it that America is not going to surrender to the New World Order. It's a declaration of independence for the 1980s and for thousands of years to come. As your forefathers declared their independence from rulers in Europe, so will we declare our independence from rulers of the one world socialist state. This slogan, this statement can be made by every man, woman, and child in America. Old or young, rich or poor, black or white, Christian or Jew, this is our message. This is our battle cry. This is the voice that will be heard around the world. Ladies and gentlemen, the future of the world is in your hands. I know you will not fail. Take up the challenge and fight to win. As General Douglas MacArthur said, there is no substitute for victory.
Charlie Provan. Doc, why don't you come up and carry on the banner. Al, do you have a distinguished service cross for him here?
Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking. This is what's known on television and radio as a commercial, so I don't want to see anybody go to the refrigerator. I wanted to say special hello to Elsa Schmidt. And Charlotte, I noticed you changed your name. Charlene Bocasek. I think I like Charlene better. So, John, I think that you're married to a strange woman. A new one. Anyways, I want to tell you something about the American Freedom Movement, where it is. It was founded and incorporated in California, Seal Beach, California, in January of 1986. So you can see that it's just come home from the obstetric ward, to be honest with you. I want to read you the beliefs and principles of this organization, and you can pick one of these up if you want to take it home from me at that table right by the coat rack afterwards. I'll put my glasses on for one reason only. I can't see. We believe there are individuals and organizations in these United States striving to turn the United States of America into a part of what they call the New World Order, and we can prove it. This would result in the loss of our national independence and make the United States one more interdependent nation in this New World Order. We believe this New World Order will include the following ingredients according to their own statements: a world tax system, a world court, a world army, a world central bank with common currency, a world welfare state, compulsory worldwide economic planning, abolition of private firearms, mandatory population control, control of all education, and a world church. We believe the above ingredients will result in the total and absolute loss of freedom, independence, and liberty as we citizens know them. We believe, as stated in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. We believe in the principle of limited self-government. We believe in the Constitution of the United States as set down by our founding fathers, and believe in the strict interpretation of this Constitution in its original meaning. We believe that man should have sovereignty over his own affairs, including but not limited to the right to life from conception to natural death, the right to liberty, the right to ownership, the right to worship according to the dictates of his own conscience, the right to associate, the right to peaceful assembly, the right to speech and publishing, the right to privacy, the right to self-defense. We believe in family sovereignty and responsibility over family affairs. We believe in justice for all under together with the idea, Al's, say no to the New World Order. Gary has finished his book with the same title, Say No to the New World Order. I was one of those that was privileged to read the manuscript. I've read it, and I always tell what I'm thinking, and he appreciated that on different aspects. I know there were five others across the United States that also helped him after he wrote it. It is right now being edited. The national group is set up with a national board of directors, and when they get large enough, they will employ a chief executive officer who will be responsible to this board of directors. They can hire him, they can fire him, they will give him the direction with power to do such things. They will produce a monthly newsletter for information, legislation, so we can have concerted efforts. Our one focus will be say no to the New World Order and keep America independent. There will be no travel by the national. There will be no dinners, no freebies, no perks, as they call in business. The only expense will be in publishing, writing, and mailing the newsletter. There will be no direct lines of enforcement, only through influence of the newsletter. On the local level, we here in Pittsburgh have already organized. We call ourselves the Greater Pittsburgh Committee of the American Freedom Movement. We organized 6 weeks ago. We have 21 individuals on our board of directors. We already have 6 committees or chapters in operation in Pittsburgh. Until the national gets going, I guess the best word for this is nature abhors a vacuum. I'm writing a monthly newsletter until the national, Gary Allen and Gary North and a bunch of others get together. So I thought, well, I'll write this just to fill in. And those who have read it, I've gotten some good comments on it, which was sort of surprising to me. Except for my own family, and they say you don't spell currency this way, you know. So nobody has a better critic than your own wife and Diane. Anyways, we have 6 committees working here. I put out this monthly newsletter. I have extra copies of May, if any of you want to read it. And incidentally, Al, I included, it was interesting, I have where to write for Barry Goldwater's Air Force thing in that monthly newsletter. And I will tell you, if anyone knows anyone who was in Vietnam, if you read those, your blood will boil. And I mean, it is the most sickening thing to be incidents where they're being fired on and they had to get permission to fire back and it was denied because that has been classified as a friendly area. Seriously, it's the most sickening thing. And McNamara was the first one, and the second one was that other Clark Clifford was Secretary of State, and this comes in three areas there, with Kissinger as the last one. But it changed, but it really was horrible on the fighting men. I have a lot of patients that fought in Vietnam. They have gotten this with an application of the American Freedom Movement, I might say. Anyways, I also have membership application. I was surprised before we even started, 2 people walked up and said, I want to join before the program, which was sort of nice. What we're doing this on a local level. We're charging $2 a month. In all honesty and seriousness, I wrote down here, we're not asking for your lives, your fortunes, or your sacred honor. We're asking you to join in our national effort, the American Freedom Movement, in order to keep America independent. Thanks.
you'd like to come up and field some questions from our audience.
Anybody? Oh, yes, go ahead. Amnesty International, the head of their research department was a comment. I don't know his name, but I know. The Amnesty International has the reputation of being a leftist organization which gently pats Soviet Union on the wrist once in a while, just to look good. But it is a left-wing organization.
The head of the research department.
The head of the research was a communist, yeah. But I don't know what his name was. I just remember reading that. Besides, the organization itself is in the left-wing camp, there's no doubt about it. When you read their reports and all, they follow right down this one world business.
Have you turned on issues there?
Chart on, let me, what's that again?
Issues.
I wanted to go over some of these charts here because, there's a couple here that I want to go over. Was the fact that all of the issues can be put under.
Let me move this back.
Right.
Over this side.
Yeah.
Still might not help all of you in that end, but.
Can't do it there, right.
Maybe you'll have to hold it up. Maybe if you want me to hold it up or...
No, that's all right. Let me just talk about it. What I'm trying to get at is what is so terribly important. And the reason that we're losing is that people are fighting the issues without putting it together. This is just overwhelming. And that's the reason, and I can't begin to tell you how important it is that you people in this room have the power to change everything simply by naming the game first. Now, let me give you some examples of these things, and I can sort of get into a few stories. A young fellow will say to me, a nephew said to me, Uncle Al, you know, I don't really think abortion is that bad. If a woman wants to have an abortion, why shouldn't she have that? So now, I've gotten to the point where I never fight an issue. I never debate an issue because all issues are debatable. You can say something on both sides, and there are good people on both sides. And what taught me this was I was at an Accuracy in Media luncheon in Washington, and I sat next to a wonderful woman, conservative woman, the wife of an admiral, and I said something about abortion, taking the conservative position, and she said, I don't care, kill them all. Like that, see? And it shocked me a little bit. I said, well, here's a good conservative, but she doesn't take this conservative position. You'll find people, even among you here, you could have differences of opinion on each and every issue, but you would not differ on the name of the game, the New World Order, you see. So that's what has. So to my young nephew, I said, well, Gary, I said, there are differences of opinion on abortion. You feel this way, and that person is concerned this way. But how do you feel about the government killing every baby once those numbers get above a certain figure? Oh, I'm against that.